I liked Ahmad as soon as I saw him. Not only was he welcoming and friendly, as were all the Wahiba we met, but he had great personal charm. My Rashid liked him too, and Bin Kabina said, "Let us try to persuade him to stay with us until we get back to Mawaki." We watered again at Hyde's near the southern coast. From there we should have been able to see Masira Island, by which I could have checked my position. But a gale was blowing and the air was thick with flying sand. We had bought a camel and had slaughtered her the previous evening. She had a large suppurating abscess on one of her feet, but Bin al-Kamam assured me that this would not affect the rest of the meat. In any case, I was too hungry to be fastidious. We hung the strips of raw meat to dry in some bushes, and I watched with rising ill temper how the grains of sand formed an ever-thickening crust over them. 16. The Wahiba Sands. From the southern coast, I visit the Wahiba Sands, and then, with the Imam's permission, return through Oman to Bahraimi. We had crossed southern Arabia from the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean, travelling along the edge of the empty quarter. But this was the sort of journey to which I was by now well accustomed. From here, however, we had to get back through Oman, a journey which, to be successful, would require diplomacy rather than physical endurance. I explained to Ahmad that I wished to travel northwards to the Wadi Bata, and then to return to Mawaki, along the foot of the mountains. This route would take me across the Wahiba Sands, which I was particularly anxious to see, since they were separated from the sands of the empty quarter by more than 150 miles of gravel plain. Ahmad said, "I myself have never been in those sands. I am from the Yahahif, and we live on the plains. But I can find a guide from the Al-Hiya, the other branch of our tribe. They live in those sands." He went on, "You are free to go wherever you wish in the country of the Wahiba. We are your friends, Mubarak. None of us would try to stop you. But the tribes under the mountains are different. They would certainly make trouble if they find out who you are, just as the Duru did. Anyway, they are all governed by the Imam, and they will be afraid to let you pass without his permission. It's different in the desert. There we could perhaps take you through the land of our enemies, travelling as raiders travel and avoiding the wells. But that is impossible in the mountains. The country is too narrow. We should have to use the paths, and they go through the villages. We could never keep out of sight. I will take you as far as I can, but just you and one of your companions. We will get hold of good camels and keep ahead of the news. As a small party, we may avoid attracting attention. We will leave the others in the Wadi Halfrain and come back to them as soon as we have been as far as the Wadi Batha. But how you are going to get to Mawaki from here, I don't know. However, we can discuss that when we return." Next day we crossed into the Wadi Andam, which here was only a few miles from the Halfrain, and following it northward, we arrived 2 days later at Nafi. The wide valley was well wooded, and would have looked like a park had it not been for the drought. Ahmed now found us a man of the Al-Hiya called Sultan, who agreed to guide us across the sands to the Wadi Bata. I decided to take Bin Kabina with me. Bin Kamam was anxious to come instead, but I persuaded him to remain in charge of the others, arranging to meet them a little farther to the north in the Wadi Halfrain, where the grazing was said to be better. I hired a fresh camel from Sultan. Bin Kabina rode his own, and both Sultan and Ahmad were well mounted. We were riding 4 of the finest camels in Arabia, and if necessary could travel both fast and far. At first we crossed a gravel plain, sprinkled with sand of a reddish tint, and broken up by small limestone tables, among which we saw many gazelle, all very wild. Gradually, as we went farther, the sand increased until it entirely overlaid the limestone floor. On the second day, we reached the well of Tawi Harain, which was about 80 feet deep. Several Wahiba were there with donkeys, but no camels. We left as soon as we had watered, for we wanted no awkward questions. We were now riding northward along valleys half a mile wide, enclosed by dunes of a uniform height of about 200 feet. A curious feature of these valleys was that they were blocked at intervals of about 2 miles by gradual rises of hard sand. The sand in the bottoms was rusty red, whereas the dunes on either side were honey-coloured, both colours becoming paler as we travelled farther north. In the evening, having climbed up to camp among the dunes, we looked across waves of sand and small crescent hollows dotted with abal bushes. We had been going for 3 hours next morning when Bin Kabina suddenly exclaimed, "Who is that?" I glanced back and was relieved to see that it was only a small boy, hurrying along to catch up with us. We waited for him. He was dressed in a white shirt and headcloth and wore a dagger. He was little more than 4 feet high and perhaps 11 years old. After we had formally exchanged the news, he stopped in front of our camels, held out an arm and said, "You may not go on." I thought, "Damn, are we really to be stopped by this child?" The others waited in silence. The boy repeated, "You may not go on." And then, pointing to some dunes 5 or 6 miles away, added, "You must come to my tents. I will kill a camel for your lunch. I will give you fat and meat." We protested, saying that we had far to go before sunset, but the child insisted. Finally, however, he gave way, saying, "It is all wrong, but what more can I do?" Then, as we were going on, he asked, "Have you seen an old grey camel in calf?" Ahmed said no. He thought a moment and added, "We passed the tracks of a young camel a little way back, and of 3 camels before that, none of them in calf." Sultan asked, "What are her tracks like?" The boy replied, "She turns her near forefoot in a little." Bin Kabina exclaimed, "Yes, don't you remember we crossed her tracks beyond that patch of light-coloured sand in the last valley? She had climbed the slope on our right and fed on some cassis. It was just before we came to the broken abal bush." The others agreed that these must be the tracks of the boy's camel, and described to him where to find them. The place was about 3 miles away. Once again, I was amazed at their unconscious powers of observation. They had been arguing the rights and wrongs of a recent killing among the Janouba, apparently paying no attention to their surroundings, yet they could now remember every camel track that we had passed. Sultan said, "God willing, you will easily find her. The tracks we saw were fresh, made after the sun had risen." The boy thanked us and turned back down the valley. We watched him as he walked away from us, his clothes very white against the red sand, and Sultan said, "Ahmad, do you remember old Salih? He died last autumn. That is his son, a good boy." 2 days later we camped on the top of the dunes, 200 feet above the Wadi Batha. The valley was about 6 miles across and was bordered on the far side by a narrow belt of sand. Beyond this were low, dark hills, and towering above these the stark range of the Hajar. In spite of the haze, I could see the peaks of Jabal Jalan near the coast at the eastern end of the range. I took bearings with my compass, while Sultan pointed out to me the various villages, most of them surrounded by palms, and all easily visible on the yellow plain. I called out to Bin Kabina to come and look, adding that I could see some Bedou encampments, but he was busy retying the pads on his saddle and called back jokingly, "What do I want with those Bedou? They did not kill my father." I joined him where he sat beside the fire, and with his help listed the plants we had seen. Ahmad and Sultan had brought me across the sands to the Wadi Batha as they had promised. I hoped that now they would not insist on going straight back across the desert to rejoin our companions in the Wadi Halfain, but would first take me westward through the villages that lay among the foothills. When I suggested this to them, Ahmad answered, "We will show you as much of the country as we can, but from now on, no one must discover that you are a Christian." In the morning, Sultan warned me as we started, "When we meet Arabs, don't say anything." I asked, "Who are you going to say I am?" And he answered, "That will depend on who they are." Bin Kabina pointed to my watch and said, "Take that off." And I dropped it inside my shirt. As we went up the valley, which is here called the Batha Badia, Sultan indicated a village half buried by sand at the foot of a dune, and said, "In time the sands will swallow this valley. A few years ago that village was inhabited." We passed several other villages, 2 or 3 of which were completely deserted, and others partly so. Sultan explained that this was due to the drying up of the aflaj, the underground channels which supplied water to the cultivations. These aflaj were probably introduced into Oman from Persia, and they are made by sinking shafts every 10 yards and joining them up with a tunnel. As they often run for miles, it must need skill to get the level right, working in the dark without instruments. I could see where several of them crossed the plain, the course of each one marked by the mounds of excavated earth. We were still on foot when we met a party of Arabs, 3 men and a boy, all armed, leading a string of loaded camels. We stopped and spoke with them. I watched their dark gypsy eyes inspecting us, coming back to me each time, never dwelling on me but missing nothing. One of them, a middle-aged man with a scar across his cheek, asked Sultan, "Is he a Baluchi?" "Yes, he has come from Sur. He buys slaves and is going to Nazwa." 4 pairs of eyes flickered over me again. It was the first of several such encounters, and each time I felt horribly conspicuous, standing then in silence, towering above the others, while they exchanged their news and the long minutes dragged by. Yet even as I waited for my identity to be discovered, I realized that for me the fascination of this journey lay not in seeing the country, but in seeing it under these conditions. Sultan insisted that we should avoid the Hath village, which we could see farther up the valley. "We do not want to meet Salih bin Isa," he said. "He is the sheikh of the Hath and head of all the Hanawi tribes. He would soon discover who you are, and even if he were friendly, the mischief would be done, for news of your presence here would get ahead of us." To avoid this village, he led us round the northern tip of the sands into a maze of bare, broken hills, some of which were of reddish colour, while others were black, slate-blue, or a dirty white. After travelling for 2 days through these hills, we reached the Habus villages in a tributary of the Wadi Andam. We had nearly finished our food, so Sultan and Bin Kabina went into Mudhaibi, where there was a market, while Ahmad and I waited for them just outside the village. Several people passed along the track and called out a greeting, but I was thankful that no one came over and spoke to us. If they had done so, they might well have remained until the others returned, and would probably have become increasingly inquisitive. Ahmad had told me that a representative of the Imam lived in this village, and I realized that if I roused suspicion here, I should be arrested and sent to Nazwa. The others came back an hour later with dates and coffee. They said that there was nothing else to be had in the village, and grumbled that what they had bought had been expensive. We continued down the valley, passing several other villages. Along the edge of the wadi were scattered palm trees and small gardens, irrigated from rivulets bordered with flowering oleanders. It was a clear day, the first one for weeks, and I could see the 10,000-foot summit of Jabal al-Aqdar, and 70 miles to the northwest the familiar outline of Jabal Khor. Around us were many other peaks and mountains. As we rode along, I stopped at intervals to sketch their outlines and to take their bearings. Of all these mountains, only Jabal al-Aqdar was shown on the map. Sultan told me that from here we must turn southwards to rejoin the rest of my party. 2 days later, as we approached a well in the Wadi Andam, my eye was caught by an outstandingly fine camel, fully saddled. At the well, a tall man, in a faded brown shirt with an embroidered woolen headcloth twisted loosely around his head, was talking to 2 boys and a girl who were watering a flock of goats. I noticed that his dagger was elaborately decorated with silver. Ahmad whispered to me, "That is Ali bin Said bin Rashid, Sheikh of the Yahahif." After we had greeted him, he said, "So you have arrived safely. You are very welcome. Your companions are near my encampment. All of them well and waiting for you. We will go there tomorrow. Tonight we will camp with some Baluchi near here. You must be tired and hungry, for you have travelled far." Then, turning to Ahmad, he asked, "Did you have any trouble?" He had steady, thoughtful eyes, a large, slightly crooked nose, deep creases down his cheeks, a straggling beard turning grey, and a closely clipped moustache, above rather full lips. It was a good-natured face, with no hint of fanaticism, but with unmistakable authority. A Bedou sheikh has no paid retainers on whom he can rely to carry out his orders. He is merely the first among equals in a society where every man is intensely independent and quick to resent any hint of autocracy. His authority depends, in consequence, on the force of his own personality and on his skill in handling men. His position in the tribe, in fact, resembles that of the chairman of a committee meeting. I had always heard that Ali possessed considerable influence, and looking at him now, I could well believe it. Ahmad fetched Ali's camel, and the five of us rode over to the Baluch encampment nearby, where we were to spend the night. It was 4 o'clock when we got there, but 11 o'clock before we sat down to a large platter heaped with tough meat and dates. About 20 men and boys collected round our fire. All of them, even the children, wore shirts. For here, unlike Darfur, it is not the custom to dress only in a loincloth. Ali had told me that these people were in origin Baluchis from Persia, but that they had lived for so long among the Wahiba that now they counted as a section of that tribe. They spoke only Arabic, and I should not have distinguished them from other members of their adopted tribe. Bin Kabina, as usual, kept his rifle always ready to his hand. Ali noticed this and said, "It is all right, boy. You can leave your rifle over there. Thanks to the Imam, God lengthen his life, we have peace here. It is not like the sands where you come from, where there is always raiding and killing." We rejoined the others late the next evening near Barida Well in the Wadi Halfain, having ridden nearly 250 miles since we had parted from them 10 days earlier. Ali urged us to go on to his encampment a few miles farther down the wadi, but instead we persuaded him to spend the night with us. Bin al-Kamam bought a goat. It was long after midnight before we fed. We spent the following day at Ali's tent. This was only about 12 feet long, woven of black goat's hair, and pitched like a windbreak under a small tree. Among these Bedou tribes, there is no contrast between rich and poor, since everyone lives in a similar manner, dressing in the same way, and eating the same sort of food, and the poorest of them considers himself as good as the richest. Ali's two wives, with whom, as is the custom here, we had shaken hands on arrival, joined us after we had fed, and sat talking with us while we drank coffee. Before we left the tent, they produced a small dish filled with a yellow oil scented with amber, and made, I was told, from sesame, saffron, and something called waris. We dipped our fingers in it and rubbed it over our faces and beards. I met with this custom only among the Wahiba and the Duru, but Bin Kabina told me that he had been anointed with a similar oil before his circumcision. Ali warned us that the Ghaffari tribes to the north had heard of my arrival among the Wahiba, and were determined to stop my going through their country. He said, "Don't think you can slip past them unobserved, as you have just done. They will be on the watch for you now. Why don't you travel along the coast to Muscat, and then go on through the Batina?" But to do this meant giving up the main object of my journey, which was to explore the interior of Oman. In any case, I was not at all anxious to encounter the Sultan of Muscat. When I had met him in Salalah after my first journey through these parts, he had been charming. Now, after another unauthorized journey, I was sure he would be furious. I told Ali that Zaid had given me a letter to Yasir, requesting him to help me, and asked him whether he thought Yasir would be able to take me back to Mwaki. "Yes," he said, "I suppose Yasir could take you through, but I doubt if he will. He won't wish to offend the Imam." There were several Wahiba camped here, some in tents, others in shelters made from tree trunks and branches. During the next 3 days, we met many more of them watering their stock at the wells which we passed as we rode up the Halfain. The Wahiba seemed to me to be a finer people than the Duru, in the same indefinable way that the Rashid had impressed me as being superior to the Beit Kathir. The Rashid lived harder lives than the Beit Kathir, which perhaps accounted for the difference between them. But the Wahiba and the Duru lived similar lives in the same sort of country. I wondered if the contrast between these two tribes was due to some fundamental difference in origin far back in the past. I sent her maid to Yasir with Zaid's letter, when we were near Adam, a small village lying in the gap between Madhamah and Salak, two mountains which rise abruptly from the gravel plain and run westwards in the shape of a crescent for 30 miles, from the Halfane to the Ameri. I had no instruments to calculate their height, but guessed that Salak was 3,000 feet and Madhamar 1,500. The limestone of which they are formed had been weathered to leave no prominent features, and no vegetation was apparent on the naked rock. Both of them were dome-shaped, and I thought regretfully that their formation was of the sort which geologists associate with oil. But even so, I did not anticipate that 8 years later an oil company would have established a camp, made an airfield, and be drilling at Fahud, not more than 40 miles away. The following day, we camped to the north of Madhamar, at Tawi Yasir, where we had arranged for Hamed to meet us. In the evening, an elderly villager joined us. He had a disapproving face, and an untidy beard, which, according to Ibhadi custom, had never been trimmed. We made coffee for him, and preceded it with a dish of dates. As soon as he had drunk the coffee, he prayed interminably, and later sat in silence, fingering his beard. After dinner, Bintahi tried to enliven the evening by being funny. The result was not happy. Our visitor suddenly got to his feet and declared that Bintahi was making a mock of him. Shocked, everyone vowed that this was not the case, that he was our guest, and that our only wish was to please him. Bin Akamam tried to mend matters by pretending that Bintahi had never been right in his head since he had fallen off his camel some years before. The man refused to be pacified, however, and finally made everyone angry by saying, "This is what happens to Muslims when they travel with an infidel." Bintahi answered immediately, "I may not be learned in religious matters, but at any rate I don't spend the whole time I am praying scratching my ass." As the man rode off into the dark, the others said, "Thank God he is gone," but I was anxious and fearful that he would cause us trouble. Next day we remained where we were, waiting for Hamed. I wondered what to do if Yasir refused to help us, and half regretted having sent Hamed to him, feeling that perhaps, had we travelled fast, we could have slipped unobserved through the country ahead of us. Now we had hung about here too long, but whatever happened, we should be able to get back to the Wahiba. Bin Kabina was sitting near me, mending his shirt. It was worn thin, and yesterday it had torn right across the shoulders. I said to him irritably, "Why don't you wear your new shirt?" He did not answer, but went on sewing. I asked him again, and he answered without looking up, "I have not got another." I said, "I saw the new one with the red stitching in your saddlebags a few days ago." "I gave it away."
"Who to?"
"Sultan."
"God, why did you do that when you only have that rag to wear?"
"He asked me for it."
"Damn the man. I gave him a handsome present. Really, you are a fool."
"Would you have me refuse when he asked for it?"
"Of course. We could have given him a few more dollars."
"When I have asked you for money, you have refused to give me any." This was true. Several times he had borrowed money to give away to people who asked for it. Twice recently I had refused to let him have any more, so as to stop this incessant scrounging of money from him, which he would later need for himself. I had told him that I would give him his money at Mwaki. I would probably need what I had with me before we got there. I said that he could put the blame on me, and tell them that I would not give him the money. Now I grumbled, "You will look well if we do meet Yasir, half-naked in that rag." He answered angrily, "Do I have to ask your permission before I can give my own things away?" Hamed returned late in the afternoon. Yasir and three other Arabs were with him. Yasir was dressed in a plain white shirt and a large embroidered headcloth. He wore a dagger and cartridge belt, and carried a 450 martini. He was a big, heavy man, who shuffled as he walked. He had prominent, ill-proportioned features, and a large beard streaked with grey. Hamed told me later that Yasir had been greatly embarrassed by my arrival, since the imam, who had heard of my presence in these parts, had given orders that I was to be arrested if I came this way. Yasir had, however, felt obliged to meet me, since I had brought a letter from Zaid. He said at once that he could not take me to Mwaki without the imam's permission, but that he would himself go to Nazwa in the morning and see the imam, and that his son would meanwhile take us to a place in the hills, halfway between Nazwa and Iz. I realized that if we went there, and if Yasir then failed to secure me a safe conduct from the imam, we should be unable to escape. I asked the others what they thought, and Bin al-Kamam said, "If you want to get back to Mawaki, you will have to trust Yasir." I therefore took Yasir aside and said, "Zaid, who is my great friend, assured me that only you, the most influential sheikh in these parts, could take me safely through Amman. I have come to you now with Zaid's letter to ask you for your help. I put myself in your hands, and am ready to do whatever you suggest." I then gave him 200 Maria Theresa dollars as a present. He answered, "Go with my son. Tomorrow evening I will meet you, and, God willing, I will have the Imam's permission for your journey." We camped next day within 10 miles of Nazwa. The town itself was out of sight, hidden behind a rocky ridge, one of many in the broken country that lay between our camp and the foot of the Jabal al-Akadah, or the Green Mountain, a name which seemed singularly inappropriate, since its slopes and precipices looked as bare as the hills that surrounded us. The atmosphere was unusually clear, and I could see its entire length. For about 50 miles it stretched across our front, its face scored by great gorges, streaks of purple on a background of pale yellow and misty blue. The Jabal al-Akadah is a single continuous ridge, and I could not decide which of the bumps and pinnacles that broke its outline was the actual summit. 10,000 feet high, it forms the highest part of a range which extends, unbroken, for 400 miles from the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean. Ahmad named the towns and villages which we could see. Pointing to a town just visible at the foot of the mountain, he said, "That is Birkat al-Mawz. Suleiman bin Hamyar lives there. He is sheikh of the Bani Riyam, and head of all the Ghafaris. The Jabal al-Akadah belongs to him. They say there is running water all the year round on the mountain, and forests of trees and lots of fruit. It is bitterly cold up there. An Arab from the mountain once told me that in the winter the rain sometimes turns into a soft white powder like salt. No, not hail. We often get hail, even down here." I asked, "Would Suleiman allow me to travel on the mountain?" And he answered, "God knows, he might. They say he is a friend of the Christians who live in Muscat. The Imam, however, would prevent your meeting him. He does not trust Suleiman." After a pause, he went on, "If you could get to Birkat al-Mawz without being stopped, I think Suleiman would take you into the mountain. No one else could take you there." Yasir came back at sunset. He had several Arabs with him. He told us that on his way to Nazwa he had met a party of horsemen sent by the Imam to arrest me. He had persuaded them to return to Nazwa, and there, after much angry argument, he had induced the Imam to authorize my journey back to Mawaki. The Imam had sent one of his men, with Yasir as his representative. I anticipated that this would be some sour-faced fanatic, and was relieved when Yasir introduced me to a friendly old man with an obvious sense of humor. Yasir had also persuaded one of the Duru sheikhs, called Huashil, to come with us. Huashil possessed the charm which Yasir so sadly lacked. I knew that accompanied by the Imam's representative, and by Rabias from Junuba, Duru, and Wahiba, I had no further cause to worry. I was very busy during the 8 days that it took me to reach Mawaki. In the desert there had been little to plot except our course, but here there was a great deal of detail to fill in. Except for the outline of Jabal al-Akadah and the position of a few of the larger towns, the existing maps were blank. I was thankful that there was no further need to conceal my identity, and that I could work openly taking bearings and making sketches. As we were passing under an enormous dome of light-coloured rock, which formed a buttress to Jabal Khor, we passed 3 men on camels. One of them, a small indignant man smothered under a large white turban, was the redoubtable Rikaishi, governor of Ibri. At the time I was riding with Bin Kabina, Bin al-Kamam, and the 2 Awamir some way behind the others. The Rikaishi had just met them. He had immediately warned Yasir that the Christian was in the neighbourhood, and added that he was on his way to Nazwa to inform the Imam. He was horrified when he heard that I was in their company, and left them without further word. The Imam's representative chuckled when later he described the scene to me. Bin al-Kamam greeted the Rikaishi as he passed, and asked him courteously if there was anything he could do for him. The Rakashi gave his camel an angry blow and answered, "You would not have brought the Christian here if you had wished to please me."
That evening, encamped outside Ibri, we heard that Bin Gabesha and another Rashid had been there a week earlier. They had visited the Rakashi, who had publicly insulted Bin Gabesha, possibly because by now he was a well-known brigand, more probably because he was known to be one of my companions. Furiously angry, Bin Gabesha got up and left the room. After dark, he waylaid the Rakashi's coffee-maker, a person of importance in an Arab household, threatened to kill him at once if he made a sound, and took him outside the town. There he tied the man up and loaded him on a camel. He then roused a cultivator and said to him, "I am Bin Gabesha. Tell the Rakashi in the morning that in return for his insults I have taken his servant and intend to sell him in the Hassa." When I met Bin Gabesha, he told me that the Rakashi had offered him $50 for the return of his servant. I asked him whether he accepted. "No. I sent back word that I realized that the man was useless as a coffee-maker. Had he not left me without coffee when I called to pay my respects to the governor? All the same, he would fetch more than that in Saudi Arabia." Eventually, the Rakashi ransomed his servant for a considerable sum. From Ibri, we rode northward along the foot of the mountains towards Jabal Hafid, passing through the territory of the Bani Kitab and Albu Shams. Both of these tribes would have stopped me if they could. But now, accompanied as I was by the Imam's representative and Rabias from the Junuba, Duru and Wahiba, they were obliged to let me pass. We reached Mwaki on the 6th of April. We had ridden 1,100 miles since we had left Zaid's fort on the 28th of January. 17. The Closing Door. Anxious to explore the Jabal al-Aqda, I returned to Bahraimi the following year, but am turned back from the Jabal by the Imam of Oman. I leave Arabia. I returned from England in November 1949, intending to complete my map of the Duru country, and, if possible, to visit Jabal al-Aqda. At Mwaki, I found Bin Kabina, his half-brother Muhammad bin Kalut, Bin Gabesha, Bin Tahi, and al-Jabari of the Awamir. Bin al-Kamam had unfortunately gone back to Darfur. The others were ready to go with me, but Bin Kabina warned me that the Duru would prevent my re-entering their territory. With Zaid's help, I sent for Huashil, the Duru sheikh who had been with me the year before. My companions admitted that, accompanied by him, we were unlikely to have trouble with the Duru, since he was one of their most influential sheikhs. He arrived 6 weeks later, while we were hawking in the sands to the west of the Mwaki, and after much argument, he promised to take me through the Duru country to Berkat al-Mawz, where Suleiman bin Hamyar lived. Only Suleiman could take me to the Jabal al-Aqda. 10 days after we had left Mwaki, we had breakfasted and were saddling our camels, when Bin Karas, the same unprepossessing and truculent sheikh who had held me up the year before, arrived with a large following of Duru, and ordered us to return at once the way we had come. That night I had been stung by a scorpion, once in the shoulder as I rolled over in my sleep, and again in the hand as instinctively I reached up. There had been no moon, and it had been very dark. I had woken Bin Tahi, who was near me, but the old man only muttered, "I expect it was a mouse," and went to sleep again. Now, although the pain had stopped, I felt dizzy and rather sick, disinclined to listen patiently to the interminable wrangling of these exasperating Duru. All that day they argued, and the following morning they still refused to let us pass. Huashil was furious. I have seldom seen a man so angry. Suddenly he shouted, "By God, we are going on, whatever you may say or do, Bin Karas," and strode off to fetch his camel. Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha led me aside, and Bin Gabesha said, "Listen to me, Mubarak. Huashil is mad with anger, and will lead you into trouble if you follow him. These cursed Duru mean business, and will shoot if we try to go on. You will be the first to die. Why die trying to see their country? What good will that do you? It is not even as if we were raiding. May God destroy these worthless Kafaris." So far I had taken little part in the discussion,
But now I called to Ashil and suggested that he should go to Ali bin Hilal, the head sheikh of the Duru, and get his permission for me to travel in their country, the rest of us remaining where we were until he returned. He had already told me that Ali bin Hilal was well disposed towards me. Huashil and the other Duru eventually agreed to this suggestion. But I heard bin Karas mutter, "The Christian is not going through our country even if 100 Ali bin Hilals give him permission. Who is Ali to give us orders?" Huashil rode off, saying he would be back in 3 days' time, and bin Karas and his followers left for some encampments nearby. In the evening, a sheikh of the Afar turned up in our camp, accompanied by a Wahiba and a Harasis. They had heard that we were in trouble with the Duru, and, being Hanawis, had come to give us their support. They assured us that they would remain with us until Huashil returned. The weather now turned horribly cold, with a tearing gale from the northeast. 3 days later, bin Karas was back demanding that we should leave, since Huashil had not returned, as he had promised. We both of us knew quite well that he would not travel in this bitter weather. For the next 2 days we argued almost incessantly. The Duru did not seem unfriendly. They agreed that I had done them no harm when I had been in their country, but maintained that if they allowed me to travel there at will, I should be followed by other Christians in cars, looking for oil, and intending to seize their land. The situation was complicated by a tribal feud among the Duru themselves. These particular Duru had been for many years at variance with the Mahamid, the section of the tribe to which the sheikhs belonged. Bin Karas, although himself of the Mahamid, was bitterly jealous of Ali bin Hilal and Huashil, and anxious to increase his own authority by lessening theirs. To divert their attention and to gain a little more time for Huashil to arrive, I offered a prize of 10 Maria Theresa dollars for a camel race. Anxious to win this money and to show off their animals, they agreed to race, after trying unsuccessfully to get me to increase the stakes. A particularly fine camel belonging to bin Karas won easily. Although the Duru seemed almost cordial after the race, the Afar sheikh advised us to leave, maintaining that they were planning to kill us. They intended, he said, to invite Huashil's 3 companions to a discussion, and then to seize and disarm them before attacking us. Like all Duru, they hated the Rashid, and apparently bin Karas was now saying that it was as meritorious to kill a Christian as to go on pilgrimage to Mecca, and in this case much less trouble. In the evening bin Karas came to our camping place and said, "The Christian must leave tomorrow morning. We are all resolved that he can remain here no longer." He refused the coffee which we offered him and left immediately. After he had gone, bin Gabesha, who was pouring out coffee for the rest of us, glanced round the hollow in which we were camped and said, "If we are still here at this time tomorrow, we shall be fighting for our lives." Bin Tahi agreed and added, "We must leave. We should not stand a chance. But by God I will come back sometime and take that camel off bin Karas. He is not fit to have one like that." My companions were certain that the Duru were not bluffing. Even if I had thought otherwise, I was dependent upon them, and forced in such a case to follow their advice. So when Muhammad asked, "What do you think, Umbarak?" I said, "We had better leave in the morning." Huashil rejoined us when we were in the sands, 80 miles to the west. He told us that Ali bin Hilal had agreed to my travelling through their country, and explained that he had waited at Ali's encampment for the wind to drop before coming back to us. I was angry that he had not returned sooner, but said nothing, not wishing to antagonize him. He promised to take us in the morning to the Wadi al-Almeri. The wind had been southerly, but next day it went back to the northeast and blew another gale. Bitterly cold off the frozen uplands of Central Asia, it was thick with sand whipped from the dunes around us. We sat throughout the day without shelter, in a reddish obscurity, half smothered by the flying grains which, reaching to a height of about 8 feet above the ground, rasped our skins, filled our eyes, noses, and ears, and were gritty between our teeth. This continuous discomfort became almost intolerable with the passing hours. Sunset brought relief, for the wind dropped and the stars came out. Next morning I noticed that the dune crests had altered a little, but but the general outline of the dunes themselves was unchanged. These sandstorms in southern Arabia must be mild compared with those that occur in the Sahara. One storm in which I had been caught on my way to Tibesti was far worse than any I experienced in the empty quarter. But even here, these sandstorms sometimes had fatal results. For instance, Bin Tahi told me of some Nasheed who followed raiders into sands that were unknown to them and died when such a storm wiped out the tracks which they were following. We travelled back through the sands and then across gravel plains through country similar to that which I had seen before. In the Wadi al-Aswad we met some Doru, one of whom was suffering from fever. I thought it was probably malaria and gave him quinine and aspirin. Next day, however, Bin Kabina went down with a similar attack. To rest him, we remained where we were. In the morning, Bin Gabesha, Bin Tahi, and one of Huaishil's Duru were sick. We went on slowly, for our water was getting short, and the evening before we reached the Amari, I myself had a high temperature and a splitting headache. But as our water was finished, we could not stop. Next day I was feeling so ill that it was an effort even to keep upright in the saddle. But as I rode along, I had constantly to check our course with my compass and note how long we had travelled on each bearing. Also, I had to write down the names of each watercourse that we crossed. Otherwise, the thread of my traverse would have been irreparably broken. It took us 5 hours to reach the Amari. Some Duru fired on us as we approached the well, but Huashal rode forward and spoke with them. They had been warned by Bin Karas that we might be coming this way, and at first they were hostile. However, Huashil persuaded them to let us pass. I recovered from my fever 2 days later, but at the time I hardly cared what they said or did, wishing only to be left alone. I think we were suffering from influenza. We heard later that there had been some sort of epidemic in Oman and several deaths. This was the only time I was ill during the years I was in Arabia. 3 days later, we were camped in the stony foothills 10 miles to the southwest of Iz. Huashil and Al-Jabari went off to Suleiman bin Hamyar at Tanuf to ask if I might visit him. After a further 3 days, they returned to say that Suleiman had invited me to Birkat al-Ma'uz. On the way back, however, they found that the hue and cry was out, and when they tried to stop in the town of Bala for a meal, the inhabitants shut their doors against them. Huashil had promptly sent a messenger back to Suleiman asking him to come to our assistance, and had then hurried on to warn us. He told us that a pursuit party sent by the Imam was close behind him, and advised us to move across the valley and camp above the village of Mamur, where we should be in his own territory. There we were joined by some Januba, who had been with me the year before, and by some Wahiba, who had come to invite me to their country. Next morning, our camel guards reported that 100 armed townsmen were collected in a watercourse nearby, and soon afterwards 4 of them came to our camp. Their leader, one of the Imam's household slaves, ordered us to leave immediately, saying that the Imam had told them to kill me unless I did so. Huashil answered that we intended to remain where we were until we heard from Suleiman. They protested strongly, and a little later were overheard arguing as to which of them should shoot me and claim the reward. We therefore warned them that we would fire at anyone who came near us. As I had with me Rabias from the Duru, Januba, and Wahiba, I thought it unlikely that they would attack us. But when the situation was getting uncomfortably tense, a messenger arrived from Suleiman bin Hamyar to say that he was on his way. He arrived in the afternoon and camped in Mamu village, a cluster of palm-frond cabins, and 2 or 3 mud buildings grouped round a small mosque. I met him there, in a courtyard, crowded with his own retainers and those of the Imam. A big man, with a sallow complexion and a long black beard, he was dressed in a brown, gold-embroidered cloak of the finest weave, and a spotless white shirt, with an expensive Kashmiri shawl wrapped round his head and sandals on his feet. His dagger was decorated with gold. He impressed me at once as a powerful, if not very congenial, personality. It was obvious from his bearing, and from the behaviour of his retainers, that he was not a tribal sheikh ruling by consent, but an autocrat accustomed to obedience. As soon as I had been served with dates and coffee, he took me inside the mosque, after stationing a guard at the entrance with orders that no one was to be allowed near. He was obviously angry with the imam for having prevented me from coming to Berkat al-Mawz at his invitation, and by meeting me here he had defied him. I doubted, however, that he would risk a more serious quarrel by taking me to the Jabal al-Aqada. I had always heard that he was without the narrow fanaticism of most Omani townsmen, and that he was interested in and prepared to use the inventions of the West. This lack of orthodoxy and his obvious ambition made him suspect with the imam. I soon realized that the imam had just grounds for his mistrust, for after we had talked for a while, sitting close together on a small prayer rug, he leant closer to me and explained in a whisper that he wished to be recognized by the British government as the independent ruler of the Jabal al-Aqada, with a status similar to that of the Trucial sheikhs. I told him that I could not help him in this matter, as I was a traveller with no official position, who had come here with no object but to explore the Jabal al-Aqada. He said, "If you can arrange what I have asked, come back again, and I will take you wherever you wish to go." I suggested that I might have some difficulty in getting away from here, as my camp was surrounded by the imam's followers, and he said, "Leave tomorrow and I will stay here for a day and make sure that no one pursues you." I was disappointed that I had been turned back when I had so nearly reached the Jabal al-Aqada, for I would have given much to have explored this mountain. I knew, however, that it would be useless to return and try again the following year. Travelling in the desert, we had always been able, when held up, either to profit from the rivalries of the tribesmen, or, if turned back, to reach our destination from another direction. The Rashid who accompanied me were Bedu, at home anywhere in the desert, even in country which was new to them, or where the tribes were hostile. But they knew nothing of either the Jabal al-Aqada or of the Arabs who lived there. I had realized, even before we had started from Mawaki, that I could only travel in this mountain with the permission of Suleiman bin Hamyar. I had reached him, and he had refused me leave to go there. We arrived back at Mawaki 10 days later, after travelling by night for the last part of the journey, in order to avoid the Al-Bushams, who were on the watch for us. I stayed there for a few days with Zaid before I left for Dubai, taking Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha with me, for I knew I would not come back, and I wanted to have them with me until I left Arabia. On our way to Dubai, we stopped for a night in an oil camp that had sprung up near the coast while I had been away in Oman. The camp boss told me that they were nearly ready to drill for oil. Dubai, where we stayed with Edward Henderson and his assistant, Ronald Codray, in their house beside the harbour, was happily still unchanged. At the oil camp, Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha had not been allowed to share the empty tent which had originally been allocated to me in the European lines, and I had therefore spent the night with them in the native lines. Henderson and Codray, however, were quite willing to treat them as their guests, and gave us a room together. Henderson asked me what to do about food, and I suggested that he should make no alterations. As we went into lunch, I said to Bin Kabina, "While I was with you in the desert, I fed and lived as you do. Now that you are our guests, you must behave as we do." They watched carefully to see how we used the knives and forks, and managed with singularly little trouble. They were far more self-possessed than most Englishmen whom I had seen feeding with their hands for the first time. Afterwards I said to them, "Your hosts wish you to have whatever you want while you are here. They have asked me to find out whether you prefer to eat our food or whether you would rather have Arab meals." Bin Kabina smiled and answered, "We shall, it is true, be more comfortable and able to eat more if we feed as we are accustomed, but Mubarak, do not mention this if it would cause embarrassment. We don't know your customs, and you must help us now as we helped you in the desert." We dined that night with the Sheikh of Dubai on the far side of the creek. The lad I hired to row us over asked if he should wait to bring us back, and I told him to return at 10 o'clock. As we were coming back to the landing stage, Bin Gabesha suddenly said, "Mubarak, we have done an awful thing." And when I asked what was wrong, he answered, We have forgotten to bring back any food for our travelling companion. Puzzled, I asked whom he meant, and he said, The boy who brought us over. I assured him that the boy would not expect it, as the customs of the town were different from the customs of the desert. But Bingabesha shook his head and said, We are Bedu. He was our travelling companion. Did he not bring us here? And we forgot him. We have fallen short. On our first day there, Bingabina accidentally shut himself up in the sitting room and was unable to get out until he attracted my attention by hammering on the wall. But soon both of them were perfectly at home and were fiddling with the wireless and playing Henderson's gramophone. Henderson and Codre were endlessly good-natured, particularly as in the early morning it amused my companions, who got up at dawn, to burst into their rooms, exhorting them, "Up and pray! Up and pray!" as they beat the beds with their camel sticks. One morning they came back before breakfast from the souk in a state of great excitement. As they buckled on their cartridge belts, they told me that a kinsman of theirs had been arrested by the Sheikh of Sharjah, and that they must go immediately to his assistance. I asked how they proposed to get to Sharjah, which was 12 miles away, and Bingabesha said, "We will hire a car. Give us some money. You know how much a car will cost." I suggested that they should wait and get a lift in a lorry, which I knew Henderson was sending there later in the morning, but they were impatient. "We cannot wait. We must go now, at once. Tell Henderson to send the lorry now." I asked, "Who is this man? Do I know him? What is his name?" And Bingabesha said, "I don't know his name, but he is a kinsman of ours. Is that not enough?" "Is he a Rashid?" I asked. "No, he is a Sharefi." By now I knew enough of tribal genealogies to realize that this small and obscure tribe was only very distantly connected with the Rashid. But Bingabesha said, "What does it matter? He is a kinsman and in trouble. We must go to his help. Would you have us desert him, Mubarak, when there is no one else to help him?" They went off in the lorry and came back in the evening. The man had been released before they got to Sharjah. Having come to Dubai by car, they had no camels to worry about, and were content to remain for a while enjoying this new experience. It would give them something to talk about when they got back to the desert. Meanwhile, they found it pleasant to sit about, fully fed, and with nothing to do but wander into the souk and gossip in the shops. I asked Bingabesha if he would care to live here permanently, and he said, "No. This is no life for a man. What is there to do?" I noticed that when they chatted together in the evenings, it was of the desert that they spoke, rather than of the things they had seen during the day. I have often been asked, why do the Bedou live in the desert, where they have to put up with the appalling conditions which you describe? Why don't they leave it, and find an easier life elsewhere? And few people have believed me when I have said, they live there from choice. Yet obviously the great Bedou tribes of Syria could at any time have dispossessed the weaker cultivators along the desert's edge and settled on their land. They continued, instead, to dwell as nomads in the desert, because that was the life they cherished. When I was in Damascus, I often visited the Ruwala, while they were camped in summer on the wells outside the city. They urged me to accompany them on their annual migration, which would start southward for the Najd as soon as grazing had come up after the autumn rains. Only in the desert, they declared, could a man find freedom. It must have been this same craving for freedom which induced tribes that entered Egypt at the time of the Arab conquest to pass on through the Nile Valley, into the interminable desert beyond, leaving behind them the green fields, the palm groves, the shade and running water, and all the luxury which they found in the towns they had conquered. Knowing that I should not come back, I advised Bingabesha and Bingabesha to return to their homelands in the south as soon as the weather got cool. Already they had many blood feuds on their hands, and I feared that they would inevitably be killed if they remained in these parts. The following year I heard that Bingabesha had collected his camels and gone back to Habarut. Bingabesha, however, remained on the Trucial coast, where his reputation became increasingly notorious. Henderson wrote and told me how he was woken in the early hours to find Bingabesha on his doorstep, seeking sanctuary with a badly wounded man in his arms. They had been raiding camels on the outskirts of the town. Henderson sent the wounded man to hospital in Bahrain, and Bingabesha went there with him. 2 years later, I saw a report by the political resident which stated that the Sheikh of Sharjah had succeeded at last in capturing the notorious brigand Bingabesha, who had been Thesiger's companion, and that he was determined to make an example of him. I was relieved when I heard soon afterwards that the Sheikh had released him after receiving an ultimatum from the Rashid and our Amir. One evening, the political officer who had taken over from Noel Jackson came to dinner. He led me aside and said, "I am afraid, Thesiger, that I have a rather embarrassing duty to perform. The Sultan of Muscat, His Highness Said Said bin Taimur, has demanded that we should cancel your Muscat visa. I have been instructed to do so by the political resident. I am afraid I must therefore have your passport." I replied, "All right, I'll get it. But you realize I've never had a Muscat visa." Although we joked during dinner about a visa for Nazwa, I realized that it would not be long before visas really were required, even for travel in the empty quarter. Even now, I was probably barred from going back there. To reach the sands, I had to start from somewhere on the coast, and I could no longer land in Oman or in Darfur. Even if I returned to the crucial coast, my presence would probably be regarded as an embarrassment by the political resident. I recalled that the previous year, the Aden government, hearing that I was planning another journey, had sent me a telegram advising me for my own sake not to enter Saudi territory. Although I had no political or economic interest in the country, few people accepted the fact that I travelled there for my own pleasure, certainly not the American oil companies, nor the Saudi government. I knew that I had made my last journey in the empty quarter, and that a phase in my life was ended. Here in the desert, I had found all that I asked. I knew that I should never find it again. But it was not only this personal sorrow that distressed me. I realized that the Bedou with whom I had lived and travelled, and in whose company I had found contentment, were doomed. Some people maintain that they will be better off when they have exchanged the hardship and poverty of the desert for the security of a materialistic world. This I do not believe. I shall always remember how often I was humbled by those illiterate herdsmen who possessed in so much greater measure than I generosity and courage, endurance, patience, and light-hearted gallantry. Among no other people have I ever felt the same sense of personal inferiority. On the last evening, as Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha were tying up the few things they had bought, Kodre said, looking at the two small bundles, "It is rather pathetic that this is all they have." I understood what he meant. I had often felt the same. Yet I knew that for them the danger lay not in the hardship of their lives, but in the boredom and frustration they would feel when they renounced it. The tragedy was that the choice would not be theirs. Economic forces beyond their control would eventually drive them into the towns to hang about street corners as unskilled labour. The lorry arrived after breakfast. We embraced for the last time. I said, "Go in peace," and they answered together, "Remain in the safekeeping of God, Mubarak." Then they scrambled up onto a pile of petrol drums beside a Palestinian refugee in oil-stained dungarees. A few minutes later, they were out of sight round a corner. I was glad when Kodre took me to the aerodrome at Sharjah. As the plane climbed over the town and swung out above the sea, I knew how it felt to go into exile.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.